It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Newly released indicators gauge the mental health of Wisconsin high school students, and there are some discouraging trends.
The Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey found that in 2023, just over half of teens reported anxiety. One in three reported daily depression for 2 weeks or longer. One in five reported self-harm.
Here's Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Underley at a news conference saying, we must do better.
As educators, as parents, as community leaders, as humans, we have the responsibility to confront this crisis head on. We have the knowledge and the resources to support our students as they attempt to wade through these challenging waters, many of them on their own.
That audio is courtesy of Wisconsin Eye. We're learning now about the survey's findings and why the mental health of young people has been declining for over a decade.
Linda Hall is the director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health. Linda, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. This report that comes from the Department of Public Instruction is so important for us to have that this data that really helps us understand the well-being of the kids in Wisconsin. And as you can tell from what you've already reported on, we've got a real mental health crisis going on right now.
Linda, you work on this issue day in and day out and working to improve youth mental health. What is your reaction to the 2023 survey results?
Well, frankly, we were hoping that some of these 10-year plus trends were going to be starting to go in the other direction. We've been seeing anxiety and depression increasing, kids' feeling of belonging, especially at school, decreasing for more than 10 years now. And we have more awareness of it since the pandemic. The pandemic maybe contributed some more to the trends, but we had really hoped to start seeing these trends turn around. At the same time, our office is really focused on making that happen, and I'd be happy to talk about that some more.
And I'm going to put a pin on that. I really want to hear some about these programs, what sounds promising. But I also want to, you mentioned the pandemic, and certainly the pandemic made things worse. The trend of more depression, anxiety among adolescents started about a decade before 2020, from 2009 to 2019, rates of major depressive disorder nearly doubled among adolescents. Can you talk about this increase and why it might have started before the pandemic?
Well, that's something we look at every day, and we're trying to put together all of the research that is going on out there and trying to create a really strong picture of that. What we know is that some things have been changing in how we live. First of all, smartphones came into existence, which means that all of us are relating to each other differently, and kids are using their phones a lot. We have some concerns about what that's actually doing to how their brains are developing, but that's a factor. We know that social media and the use of social media has increased. And that, especially for girls, there have been some really negative side effects of the content that they have been flooded with on the social media. Not that they're looking for, but what is being delivered to them. So there's that. And then with the pandemic, I think the biggest effect is that, that kids were separated from their friends, that all of us did a lot less of seeing people in person. And those in-person connections are so critical to how we feel, our well-being generally, and our mental well-being. So disrupting those connections was another factor that is contributing to all this. Kids tell us that it's those factors plus climate change, worries about gun violence, and political divisiveness.
The survey found, you mentioned this, that girls and LGBTQ plus youth are at the highest risk for depression, anxiety, and self-harm. What might be some of the causes of this disproportionate risk?
Well, I think I'd take you back to the issue that girls are being confronted constantly with images about being thinner. They're on social media, they're getting some negative messaging about themselves, they're also they're getting messages that they're not yet emotionally equipped to deal with. And so we really encourage people to, you know, if you're a parent, have a family media plan, limit the time that your kids are on the social media. If you're a young person, do a little curating of what you're looking at on social media. Make sure that you're looking at positive things, things that help you. I think, and that's important for the LGBTQ kids. They, in many ways, are getting important connections through social media, but they need to, you know, focus on where it's a positive experience for them and not do it for too long. We're seeing kids are on for too many hours in a day, which takes away from their being outside, being physical, which is important for your well-being. And it's also taking away sleep. Kids are not getting this 8 hours of sleep that they used to get. And that's important for combating depression and for brain development.
Linda Hall is with us, directs the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, as we talk about the 2023 Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey, the results recently published in a report by the State Education Department. Linda, another troubling data point here in this report is about hunger and teens reporting not having their basic needs met. One in four students reported experiencing hunger due to a lack of food in their house during the past 30 days. How does hunger intersect with mental health?
Yes, that was a figure that I was not aware of and I was surprised by. I didn't realize it was that pervasive, but we do know that kids who are experiencing food insecurity, they're not able to function as well at school. They don't feel like they belong at school, and they're also being bullied more than other kids. So those kids have a lot of things in their way. And let me just say that when kids come to school and they're hungry or they're tired or they're depressed, they're not in a mindset to be able to learn. And so all these things are really important. And belonging at school is one of the things that gets kids to school. And when they get to school, if they're there with an open mind, fed and not depressed, they're more likely to learn and then move on to better careers and better wages after school.
Well, let's talk about the school setting. The current state budget includes spending $30 million for the Get Kids Ahead program, which helps schools provide the comprehensive mental health services. Are there still gaps in prevention in schools?
I would say that sustainable, more increased funding for school mental health is the most important thing that we need to do as a state. The $30 million that is in the budget this time is time-limited money that came that ends at the end of the biennium. It also was implemented in a way that was without a formula that really allows for the money to go equally and fairly to small schools as well as larger schools. It was a step forward in terms of moving it from a grant program to a per pupil program. But in that, there was a step was missed in order to make sure that rural schools didn't lose the money that they had. The reason that school mental health funding is so important is because few kids actually get mental health treatment. And 75% of those who get it are likely to get it at school. And there are lots of things that we can do at school to, you know, create an atmosphere where kids are going to thrive. So allowing that to happen, allowing mental health professionals to be there and to support our school social workers and school counselors to have the time to address kids' issues are very important things.
In this survey, there is this space for the teens to say what they wish. And there are some quotes here. One that stuck out to me is, "We are rapidly becoming the most depressed and zombied age group of all." That was really chilling. And I know your office is really trying to work on stronger connections among youth. What is showing promises with the programs that you're working on?
Yes, actually, that is our number one focus, is how can we increase kids' social connections and how can we help them feel more like they belong? Let me just say that one thing that we do have to recognize as we look at all these numbers is that there is a lot more freedom to talk about mental illness and about feelings. So we think that that is a factor in what's going on, that kids are more open to talking about how they're feeling and asking for help. But what we're hearing right now is that their needs for help are continuing to outpace what's available to help them. In terms of what we can do, we can all do things to make a difference in kids' lives. You know, just a 40-second interaction with a young person can reduce their anxiety. When it comes to being a supportive adult, one thing you can do is to just listen. Listen real intentively. And if you're a parent, listen. Don't try to fix things right away. Just hear where they're at and see how they're doing with their feelings. See how they're managing their stress. And then maybe work with them on some good coping skills. And as a parent, model good coping skills and model putting down your phone and interacting with a person face to face.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. I appreciate you covering this topic. It's something that is very serious, but something that we can all contribute to making this a better place for our kids.
That is Linda Hall. She is the director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, talking with us about the state's 2023 Youth Risk Behavior Survey, why teens continue to struggle with mental health challenges. If you or someone you know is dealing with thoughts of suicide, call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Again, it's three digits, 988.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out how a rainy summer is bringing more mosquitoes and why climate change could make things worse.
When you have a shorter winter and a longer warm spell, you're going to have more mosquitoes.
That's coming up here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When you get outside this year, do you hear that annoying buzzing sound around your ears more often than usual? Maybe you're feeling a little itchier than usual from mosquito bites. With above average rain this year, Wisconsin can feel like a mosquito paradise.
If you're seeing a big mosquito year, or not so much, let us know about it. You can always email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
To get a handle on this year's mosquito season, we're going west of the border to Minnesota. They have mosquitoes, same as us, but they have something we don't have, an official mosquito control agency that covers the most populated part of the state.
Minnesota's Metropolitan Mosquito Control District has been reporting mosquito data and controlling their population in the region for nearly 70 years.
Daniel Huff is executive director of the Mosquito Control District. Daniel, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, no secret, it's been a big year for rainfall in Wisconsin, I imagine over there in Minnesota too, especially compared to last year. I tend to think wet year, more mosquitoes. Has it panned out that way this year?
Oh, yes. Now, we have benefited somewhat from 3 years of drought in that our summer mosquito populations are not as bad as they could be. I know sometimes it doesn't feel that way. But our summer mosquitoes are actually lower than our 10-year average right now.
Can you talk a little bit about the life cycle of the mosquito and how drought versus wet year affects the breeding of mosquitoes and, I guess, the population of mosquitoes?
Yeah. Well, first, there's different types of mosquitoes that come around different parts of the year. So in the spring, we have what are called the snowmelt mosquitoes. Obviously, they come out when the snow melts. Those were really bad this year. And they were really bad because last year we had a lot of snow, a lot of snow melt, a lot of mosquitoes who then laid a lot of eggs. So every time you get bit by a female mosquito, they're biting you so that they can go lay a bunch of eggs. They use that blood to nourish their young that they're creating. So we had a lot of bad mosquitoes this spring. Now, those spring mosquitoes kind of live all year until they get eaten or, you know, damaged in some way. Then you have your summer mosquitoes. And those start around May or June up in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And they will have many, many broods. So every time it rains an inch or more, they are out there biting you and then laying eggs. Now, they don't live as long, but they keep reproducing all summer long. And then you have your cattail mosquitoes. They come out really bad around July 4th. Great time for our July 4th picnics. They are the most aggressive biters that we have up here in the upper Midwest. And they actually live over winter. And then we have mosquitoes that are kind of just around all the time. And unfortunately, some of those mosquitoes, we call them Culex, are those that also carry West Nile virus. As you know, mosquitoes are a particular concern as a vector of disease.
We'll dig into disease more in a few moments, but something you said made me think climate change. We're worried about earlier thaws and later frosts. Is that extending the breeding season for any of those mosquito varieties you were just talking about?
Absolutely. It's extending the range, so we're getting mosquito species that we don't normally get up here in the upper Midwest. One of the beautiful side effects of our harsh winters is they kill off a lot of mosquitoes that you might have down south. But as those winter changes, we risk having mosquitoes move up here and stay, being able to survive our winters. When you have a shorter winter and a longer warm spell, you're going to have more mosquitoes. Mosquitoes need two things to reproduce. They need water and they need warm temperatures. And the longer the summer, the more mosquitoes we're going to have.
Now, you mentioned West Nile. A lot of us, I think, and the public, Daniel, will think of mosquitoes as, you know, a nuisance. We don't want to get bit. We don't want the itches. You're worried about public health here. What are some of the concerns we have about mosquito season when it comes to communicable diseases?
Yeah, Rob. Well, that's a great question. And, you know, the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District is at its heart a public health agency. Now, we like to make people's summers better and more enjoyable, but our primary function is to prevent the spread of disease that are caused by mosquitoes. I think we all know that, you know, in many parts of the world, mosquitoes carry malaria. You may have seen the statistic that mosquitoes are the most dangerous animal in the world. They kill more humans than any other animal, including other humans. And it's because they carry disease. Now, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, we worry about West Nile virus. That's actually a disease that is carried by birds, but then mosquitoes transfer it from birds to us. We're also worried about lacrosse encephalitis, especially in children. This can be highly dangerous and deadly to children. Encephalitis means that it's attacking the brain. We have Jamestown Canyon virus. We have Eastern equine encephalitis that kills horses as well as can kill people. These are all diseases that are spread by mosquitoes. So we at MMCD, or the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District, we monitor and do surveillance on mosquitoes as well as disease, and then we really target that to control those mosquitoes to prevent the spread of those diseases.
Can we target mosquito controls to, this species of mosquito carries, say, West Nile, so we're going to focus on them? Can we be that fine-tuned?
Well, we can by looking at their habitat. So just like every other animal, different species of mosquitoes live in different habitats. The mosquitoes that carry West Nile, they like mucky, kind of gross water. So anywhere you have water that is stagnant and has a lot of organic material, you're going to have these Culex mosquitoes. An area that we focus on are catch basins. So these are storm drains that you have in the street, but they're the ones that have the water in a sump that keeps the water in there. And we make sure that we treat those once a month to make sure that we're really suppressing those mosquitoes that carry West Nile. The mosquitoes that carry La Crosse encephalitis, they like to live in little containers, and they don't fly very far. Some mosquitoes can fly 5 miles. These that carry La Crosse, they only travel maybe 500 feet or so. So they're going to be in your yard breeding in that old tarp you got in the back that has a pool of water in it, an old bucket, maybe a stopped up rain gutter. So that we want people to control by removing those habitats of those little pools of water.
Looking to the future, now you mentioned malaria, not currently a worry in the Midwestern United States. People may remember the big worries about Zika virus some years back. Again, not currently being transmitted, I don't think, anywhere in the United States. Do you have concerns that down the road, with cumulative years of climate change, mosquitoes might move north, mosquitoes that can carry some of those diseases right now we only read about in, you know, foreign news headlines?
Absolutely. I think that's the biggest risk to us with climate change around mosquito-borne diseases. You know, we're already seeing that in California and Florida and Texas. We have cases of dengue, also known as breakbones fever, because it feels that bad. We are concerned. We have actually the mosquito that can transmit malaria actually does live in Minnesota and Wisconsin, but we just don't have any people or have very few people that are infected with malaria for those mosquitoes to bite and then transfer to someone else. But as some of these southern mosquitoes are allowed to live as our winters warm up, we are concerned that those diseases will migrate with them, dengue, Zika, malaria, et cetera.
Daniel Huff is with us, Executive Director of Minnesota's Metropolitan Mosquito Control District. We're talking about mosquito season this year and in the future. Daniel, you know, we do mosquito research here in Wisconsin through the university, Department of Health Services, and so on. We don't have this thing, a Metropolitan Mosquito Control District sort of thing, where there's a coordinated effort like this. Tell us a little bit about this outfit.
Yeah, well, the Minnesota legislature in 1958 set forth that we were going to have a 7-county independent unit of government whose sole purpose was to track and control mosquitoes. And we're very fortunate to have that. So the 7-county metro area, that's Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's about 3,000 miles. So that's about 2 Rhode Islands. And by focusing in this large area, we're able to control and suppress mosquitoes in the whole region. You know, as I said earlier, mosquitoes can fly about 5 miles, and just treating one little area doesn't mean that you're protecting the people who live in that little area. So we're fortunate in Minnesota. We have this independent governmental unit. But our sole function is tracking and treating mosquitoes. We track ticks. We also control black flies or biting gnats.
You mentioned treatment. What kind of things do you do to treat waters in particular to help lower those mosquito numbers?
Yeah, well, first of all, when people, you know, think about like pesticides, we really worry about how is it impacting other insects, bees, butterflies, dragonflies. We are very conservation and environmentally focused here at MMCD. So what we do for our treatment is we do larval treatment. We get the little guys when they are still larvae in the water. We use particular substances like a bacteria that only targets mosquitoes and very closely related species. So it leaves dragonflies and caddisflies and everything else completely alone. So what we do is we target those mosquitoes that are larvae. Now, larvae, it means you got about 5 to 7 days before they hatch, so we have to move quickly. But by doing that, we eliminate the risk to all those other wonderful insects like pollinators.
I know another concern about spraying is that spraying for mosquitoes, a lot of times you got a new pesticide. It works great in year one, pretty good in year two. Pretty soon evolution catches up with you. Mosquito numbers start to bounce back up. Do you see similar problems with the ways you treat these larvae? Are you in this evolutionary arms race here?
Yeah, that is a great question. So the good news about the bacteria that we use, this soil bacteria called BTI, it actually has a number of different strains of the bacteria. So we're feeling pretty confident and we've not seen any resistance to that treatment. We do have some other treatments. One is called methoprene, and that is a synthetic hormone that basically makes the mosquitoes never grow up. They just stay as a larva. There have been studies, for example, in Chicago that have shown resistance building. So we make sure that we rotate the various types of materials that we use because we do not want a mosquito to develop a resistance to any of these treatment options.
I know we humans aren't nuts about mosquitoes. They bite us. They spread disease. Some animals eat them. How much do we rely on mosquitoes in the food chain?
Yeah, that is a great question. So one of the things to remember about mosquitoes is they're really small. So a lot of birds and bats are actually going to go for larger prey. You know, a moth, that's like a Big Mac, and a mosquito is like maybe a bit of a French fry. So they are not as important, say, for some of your larger vertebrate species, but they are important part of the food web. You know, they take a lot of biomass from the water and put it back into the sort of terrestrial ecosystem, if you will.
The model you have there as a state-run agency tackling mosquitoes, is this something you evangelize about to states like Wisconsin that don't have a similar effort, or do you see, you know, different bureaucratic models maybe working just as well?
Well, we're really fortunate in Minnesota in that we have we're the largest multi-county district in the country. We by serving such a large area, we are able to be very efficient in our use of resources. We have a large tax base to draw from. Our average taxpayer here in the metro area pays about $10.80 a year. So about the price of a can of repellent. And we're able to treat the entire region. So it's a great model, I think. It works well for Minnesota. I'm obviously not going to tell Wisconsin what to do here, but I will tell you it works well for us.
For people wondering, hey, are there things I can do, you know, in my own yard to help with mosquitoes? What kind of advice do you have for them?
Yeah. First of all, get rid of your breeding habitat. You know, that old tarp, that old bucket. Mosquitoes are amazing in they can grow. I've seen a picture of mosquito larvae in a Coca-Cola bottle cap. They don't need a lot of water to grow. So eliminate those sources of water. Do what you can to help promote other beneficial insects, other beneficial vertebrates, you know. Birds and bats, while they're not major consumers of mosquitoes, will consume them. So those are some of the things that you can do. It's really about reducing habitat, reducing those little puddles of water that might collect in your yard.
Getting back to those diseases you mentioned, I wonder how you monitor for those. Because, you know, I'm not going to call you and tell you every time I got bit by a mosquito. I'm sure you don't want me to either. But how do you spot when West Nile or the lacrosse encephalopathy or other diseases start popping up? Encephalitis, I'm sorry, not encephalopathy.
Good question again. So we work closely with the Minnesota Department of Health. And if they have a human case, they let us know where they are so that we can focus, especially, as I mentioned, lacrosse encephalitis, very targeted, usually in just a couple of yards away from somebody. So we can go and investigate, treat that area. We also have our own network where mosquitoes we catch, we actually test the mosquitoes for disease, especially for West Nile virus. So we know where in the district West Nile is currently being found in infected mosquitoes through this surveillance network that we do in our own laboratory.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, and I hope that you have a wonderful summer with as few bites as possible.
You too. Thanks.
Daniel Huff is Executive Director of Minnesota's Metropolitan Mosquito Control District. He talked to us about how our neighbors to the west handle their mosquitoes.
Earlier this week, we talked about live music in Wisconsin with Peter Jest, music promoter and owner of Shank Hall in Milwaukee. And we asked for your favorite live show of all time.
Lynn emailed, "Hi, the most amazing show I ever attended was at Shank Hall, perhaps late 90s, when Peter brought Buena Vista Social Club to Shank Hall. There were 13 people on stage. I was up near the front row. Older guys, including many all-stars on the stage. Sounds awesome, Lynn. Thanks. Keep sharing your best live music show memories. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, it's our state's top athletes from the Lumberjack World Championships in Hayward on the tools of timber sports.
I use a little smaller axe. It's about 6 pounds and it is razor sharp. It'll shave your arm if need be, or worse.
That's up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with the story of a Watertown native's brief but memorable role in The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz is a beloved, iconic film that has captivated generations. Author Dean Robbins of Madison tells us the story of a Watertown, Wisconsin native whose small role in the movie was part of a big and fulfilling life.
Meinhard Robbie appeared in only one movie, 1939's The Wizard of Oz. But as the coroner of Munchkinland, he makes an impression. The role was enough to ensure Robbie a seven-decade career. It included speaking engagements, an autobiography, mountains of fan mail, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. When he died in 2010, obituaries ran in major media, and all because of a mere 13 seconds on screen. Meinhard was born in 1915 in rural Farmington, Wisconsin. As a teenager at Johnson Creek High School, he stopped growing at about 3.5 feet. In 1934, he worked as an announcer at the Chicago World's Fair to put himself through school at Watertown's Northwestern College. Then he transferred to the University of Wisconsin and graduated with a business degree in 1937. Robbie hoped to be an accountant, but despite his good grades, faced discrimination, as he told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1980.
At that time, the public conception of little people or midgets was that while they didn't come out and say so specifically, their idea was that because we didn't grow up physically to normal size, we couldn't have developed normally mentally either.
Oscar Meyer recognized Robbie's talent as a performer, honed at the World's Fair. The company hired him to tour the country as Little Oscar, the world's smallest chef. In 1938, however, Robbie requested time off from his job when MGM Studios put out a call for little people to appear in a certain movie.
And the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
The studio cast more than 100 actors to play Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz and needed 9 for speaking parts. Robbie's featured role as the coroner was no fluke, as he told Fresh Air.
I feel that the reason I was selected is because I had done quite a bit of public speaking, both at school and for clubs and things during my school years, so that I had possibly a little better enunciation and more emphatic delivery than some of the others.
In the Munchkin scene, Robbie's character must confirm that the Wicked Witch of the East is authentically deceased. Outfitted in a pointy beard and purple hat, he lends the coroner a stately presence. He unfurls the death certificate and recites his famous lines.
As coroner, I must have her. I thoroughly examined her. And she's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead.
In August 1939, Robbie returned to Watertown as a special guest for The Wizard of Oz's local premiere. During World War II, he took a break from celebrity appearances to serve in the Civil Air Patrol, drawing on his aviation skills. Throughout his life, he maintained ties to Wisconsin and donated generously to a Watertown facility for people with developmental disabilities. Today, you can follow County Road B to Meinhard Robbie's gravesite in a quiet Farmington cemetery. And you can meditate on the fact that, as we learned in The Wizard of Oz, dreams really do come true.
Many people ask me, don't you wish you were big? And I say, absolutely not. I feel I've had as an interesting time of my life as any big person.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story about the Wizard of Oz actor and Watertown native, Meinhard Robbie. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Brad Colbert.
This is Wisconsin Today.
As elite athletes compete for greatness at the Paris Olympics, Wisconsin is host to a world-class championship of its own.
Last weekend, the Lumberjack World Championships were held in Hayward, featuring timber sports like log rolling, axe throwing, tree climbing, and various chopping and sawing events.
We have a pair of world champions who hail from Wisconsin. They're here to talk about their journey to competing in timber sports.
Livy Papadopoulos is the now 6-time women's log rolling world champion from Holman. Livy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
And from Hayward, we have Kate Witkowski, who is the 2024 Women's Standing Block Chop World Champion. She's also third place in the women's all-around competition. Kate, welcome.
Yeah. Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So you being from Hayward, where the championships are held, Kate, can you describe the atmosphere, what the energy is like?
Yeah, so I've lived in Hayward for over 6 years now. I didn't grow up here, but I was drawn here in part because of the Lumberjack World Championships. And this weekend of the year is by far my favorite weekend of the year in town. The energy surrounding World Championships is just such a blast. There are athletes that come from all over the world, and it really is the best athletes in the world competing at just a really, really unique venue. It's really well run, and the audience is always there cheering loudly, and that makes a big difference. So it's a really, really fun, exciting environment at World Championships here in Hayward.
Livy, I wonder, for you going to Hayward and this tradition of, you know, lumberjacks competing dates back, you know, over a century, Hayward having this long history of the competition, how does that tradition feel to you as a competitor?
It is so special. I started competing in Hayward when I was 11 years old in the amateur log rolling divisions, and I just kind of grew up going to Hayward and spending a week there every single summer for the World Championships.
So you mean to say that the youth events in the World Championships, that early years of log rolling really hooked you?
Absolutely, yeah. I started log rolling when I was 8 years old at the La Crosse YMCA. And we still have a program in La Crosse. We have over 150 kids annually. But yeah, I just signed up for a bunch of different sports, and log rolling happened to be one of them. And it turned out to be my passion, and I took off with it.
And for you, Kate, standing block chop world champion, can you tell us about this event?
Sure. So that's one of the standing block chop is one of five chopping and sawing events that the women compete at World Championships. So we have two chopping events, a standing block chop, which simulates felling a tree. And then we have an underhand chop, which simulates bucking up the tree once it's already fallen on the ground. And then we have three other sawing events, a single saw and then two doubles events. And I'm lucky enough to be past champion with my doubles events partners. We didn't take home the gold this year, but this year in the standing block chop was my first individual title. So that was really special. And that's a new event for women. Women in the chopping and sawing events haven't had the many years that the men have had. And so the women have only been competing in that event for about 5 years, less than 5 years. So it's been really special to see the whole field of women take off and really drive each other to excellence in that event. And so I was really proud to take that one home this year.
Can you talk a little bit about your tools of the trade, the axes, the saws? What is regulation for competition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the tools that we use, the equipment that we use makes a big difference, but it's not the kind of stuff you can just go down to the local hardware store and pick up. I get most of my axes from Tuatahi in New Zealand. And then I have an axe grinder in the United States fit the axe to me and then handle the axe with a special axe that I get from West Virginia, or a special handle that I get from West Virginia. And each axe runs me about $600. And we all have kind of a slew of axes to pick from, depending on the type of wood that we're cutting or the type of event that we're doing. The standing block chop, I use a little smaller axe, but it's about 6 pounds and it is razor sharp. It'll shave your arm if need be, or worse. But yeah, so they're really, really special equipment that takes a lot of investment from the athletes to get to the point where we have competitive gear.
Oh, wow. And for you, Livy, what goes into preparing for log rolling and, you know, as you get ready for competition? What is that like?
Holy cow, there's a lot. I train all throughout the year, especially during the spring and summer. And I'm usually on the log at least 3 hours a day during the spring and summer months. I also do a lot of lifting and running and cross training to keep myself in shape throughout the year. And then as far as competition goes, I would say my biggest challenge is keeping my nerves under control, because I get very nervous. Which I've come a long way with, but there's definitely a lot that goes into preparation, both with getting yourself into shape as well as getting yourself into the right mindset.
What goes through your mind as you're log rolling? What is that focus like?
You have to focus in. You have to zone everything out, because if you become distracted or if your mind isn't where it's supposed to be and you take one misstep, it's over. There's really not a lot of room for mistakes in log rolling when you're in the heat of the battle in the moment. My mind definitely does wander once in a while, but most of the time I'm just focused on what my opponent is doing, where my body is at, and how I can either get them off the log or hang on myself. Yeah, and then as far as like psychologically, you want to keep your training secrets to yourself for the most part. And there are all different kinds of ways, like I mentioned, that people prepare for competition. I usually kind of keep to myself and my family and friends that are there and just keep a calm mindset throughout the tournament.
Kate, will you disclose any of your training secrets?
Yeah, I don't know that I have any secrets. I think all of us kind of, I think in the chopping and sawing side of the lumberjack bowl, as we like to say, a lot of us are really sharing as much as we possibly can, to help us grow the sport and make sure that there
continue the sport after we kind of tire out. I don't know that I have any secrets, but I definitely can resonate with what Livy's saying about keeping your mind in the game.
Do you face any challenges as a woman in a sport that some people might associate with men who are lumberjacks?
Yeah, I think when I first started, I started competing about 12 years ago, and the women in the sport, the chopping and sawing side of things, have really, our field of competitors has really grown. Our opportunities have really grown. When I first started before then, there were just a handful of women that were really pioneering the sport, and they started mostly because their boyfriends and husbands needed a Jill partner in the Jack and Jill events. So they kind of were willingly or unwillingly dragged along to those events. And over time, I think, you know, the women started saying, hey, I think I can do this too. And so that's kind of how I started as well. I got kind of convinced by a friend in college, and I remember the first swing I took, I was hooked. And so the past few years I've been really proud to be a part of a field of women that's advancing the sport. And in part, we're doing that with the support of a lot of the men that have been in the sport. You know, there's certainly naysayers out there that maybe don't think women should be doing the sport, or that because we can't swing an axe as big or as fast as the men, that it's not worth it. But, you know, we have our own skills and talents in our own right, and we have our own worth in our own right. And I'm just really proud to see the women's field growing and advancing, and honestly, for a lot of people, proving them wrong. And that's also been rewarding too, to, you know, show that we can do it and we can be good at it. And we just have to have our conviction in that and kind of stay the course ahead. So.
And Livy, you're a leader in log rolling and 6 years in a row world champion. Where do you take the sport from here?
That is a great question. So I, growing up, always dreamed of becoming a pro world champion. It was something that I wanted to do. I didn't realize I would have 6 world titles at this age. Sometimes I take a step back and remember that I'm only 23 years old. I haven't graduated college yet, and I have my whole life ahead of me. And I'm going to keep log rolling as long as I can. I love it just as much, if not more, than when I was a little 8-year-old taking classes at my local Y. So I'm just going to continue to challenge myself and keep going. I also coach and run a couple of the programs in lacrosse. So I'm going to keep doing that as well and just see where things go.
Livy, do you think there's a possibility that timber sports might one day be a demonstration sport at the Olympics?
I absolutely do. I would really love to see that happen. I don't know if it'll happen while I'm still competing, but I would love to see that happen in my lifetime for sure.
Well, Livy and Kate, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. It was great to chat with you.
That was Livy Papadopoulos, the 6-time women's log rolling world champion from Holman, and Katie Witkowski of Hayward, the women's standing block chop world champion, who also took 3rd place in the women's all-around competition. We talked with them about the 2024 Lumberjack World Championships held last weekend in Hayward. Now, Wisconsin is home to dozens of water ski show teams and clubs.
Like the Aquanuts in Twin Lakes and the Minocqua Bats, one of the oldest water ski clubs in the world.
In a future program, we'll check in with the Rock Aqua Jays. The ski team was forced off the water, unable to do shows in Janesville for much of the summer as the Rock River swelled. But now they're back on track.
What are your favorite water ski shows and the tricks they perform, like the Human Pyramid? Maybe you're on a water ski team and have some stories to share. We want to hear about them.
And I want to see you at the top of the pyramid, Rob.
That is very... I can't ski. I'm not very well coordinated. Yeah, that would be a very short performance, I'll say that.
Get in touch with us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. You can also text us, 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.